You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, I'm Sarah Custer, and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast and a new series we're introducing that looks at the path to university leadership. We'll be interviewing vice chancellors, rectors, and university presidents from around the world about what events led to them becoming heads of their institutions. We'll be discussing their leadership styles, their biggest challenges, and asking what advice they would give to aspiring university leaders. First up is David Llewellyn, Vice Chancellor at Harper Adams University in the UK. He's been at the institution since 1998 and leading it for the past 10 years. He began by telling me about coming to the role from a slightly unique angle, from a university administration track rather than an academic one.
It's been a little bit different for me than most vice chancellors, I expect, because I came from a university administration background. Mm-hmm. And I worked in a variety of institutions, mostly in London, both small and large, in a variety of roles as well, in the state's departments, in the student registry, and in other functions. So coming into this role at Harper Adams was a little bit unusual for me, because although I had all the business elements, the background to what I needed to do, obviously there were things on the academic front that I needed to learn pretty quickly.
And that is something that I think a lot of vice chancellors kind of grapple with. They're either coming from the academic side of things or coming from the more administrative side of things. So how did you confront that challenge?
Yeah, probably a few more from the academic side of things in the UK at least. But I really set out to learn a lot more about our academic work through my previous role here, because I'd been the head of the administration for a number of years. And during that role, I was very much involved in strategic planning for the institution, working with the then principal of the university college, as we were in those days, really getting to the heart of what's made the academics tick and understanding what their pressures were as well. So I've tried to carry that through into my current role as vice chancellor. And it's really important, I think, to be able to understand that side as well as all the other things that one has to do as a vice-chancellor to promote the institution and to make sure it's run efficiently and effectively.
And you were part of the university's transition from being a college to a full-fledged university. Can you tell me about some of the leadership challenges that you face in that quite unique moment in the university's history?
Two transitions, in fact. The first one was around 1999, when we became a university college after having been an agricultural college for nearly 100 years. So that was a big transition, and that was the point at which we had to make sure that students understood particularly why we were making the change. We'd already got at that point tort degree awarding powers. We were on the road to getting research degree awarding powers, which we got in 2006. So by the time that we came to change from a university college to a university in 2012, we had everything that a university has and needs to have. We were just really at that stage then changing the title. That too took a little bit of transition work, because we had to make sure that people understood that we were already a university in all but name, but were becoming university in title, and that we were very serious about the fact that becoming a university meant that we would be then a little bit more visible, I suspect, amongst other universities in the UK sector. As a university college, you can sometimes be slightly hidden away, not featured in league tables and so on. So that meant that we had to make sure that we were visible and competing on a level playing field with everybody else.
So you're kind of putting your head above the parapet.
Absolutely.
Much more with university status.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could tell me how university leaders can make a real impact and not just be kind of perhaps puppets of governing boards or maybe being more on the back foot responding. How could you say university leaders can really kind of drive an agenda and make a real impact?
It's an interesting debate, really, because my doctorate was in university higher education governance, university governance. And I think the key thing there, because I was looking at relationships in governing bodies, was managing the relationships so that you can work with the governing body and that you are able to gain their trust in what you're doing as an effective senior team. It's not just, of course, the vice chancellor or the head of institution that has that responsibility. It's the senior team that really has to gain that trust. And I think that in terms of making the transition, making an impact, if you like, it's really around trying to make sure that you are working with your staff, connecting with them to understand what it is that they have to do on a day-to-day basis, then standing back a bit and letting them get on with it. I think that's a real lesson for leaders of institutions, because you have very, very able people in your organizations, but you need to give them the direction that they need and then the ability to get off and, you know, really do what they need to do and do it well. Then I think the other thing is that you have to manage the regulatory framework that we've got. Mm. And that means paying attention to some of the detail that goes on within that framework. But again, without delving too much into interfering in the detail. So having the ability to get that helicopter view, but not really get engaged too much is important. I guess my team might say that I do engage too much in some things, but you know, that's just by the nature of things you do. But I think it's important to try and let people do what they need to do, but funnel them into the right direction. That's the important thing.
So kind of creating a space for them to kind of get on and for their talents to excel.
Use their initiative, be creative, all the things that universities are supposed to deliver. If we corral people too closely, then they're not going to be able to do that. If we try to put them on too much of a path that says you have to do X before you do Y, and it's too structured, I think that really doesn't help in terms of the creativity that we need to see in universities. So I think that part of the problem that we've got is that we are having to work in some of those ways now because of the way in which we're regulated. Some of that is going to impact, I think, in due course on the ability for universities to be agile about what they need to do, because we're going to have to adapt pretty rapidly to a very changing, fast-changing world.
Mm. Which just kind of puts more pressure on the role of university leaders. And I think it's quite interesting considering your background and your professional pursuit of this job specifically, which is quite unique, as you mentioned earlier, among university vice chancellors. I'm wondering if you think it's still a desirable job, if there are people out there today who are kind of thinking about it and are really kind of setting their sights on specifically being a university leader, and what we need to be doing to facilitate that pipeline to this position.
Well, I think it is a desirable job. If you have the ambition and the willingness to lead an institution, it does take a lot out of your personal life. You do have to make some compromises. And it is something which you need to have a degree of dedication towards, because if you don't do that, you're not going to do the job effectively. But I think it is nonetheless a very challenging role, and one in which there are an enormous number of things you can do to work with your institution, work with the staff and the students to try to improve the way in which the organisation operates, but also to connect to the outside world. And I think that's a really important part of a vice chancellor's role, those connections and what you're able to do and bring into the institution, whether it be with industry, other stakeholders in the local political landscape, or even at national level. Really, really important. And I've set up really from day one to say, I want to bring people to Harper Adams to be able to show them what we do, because often they won't necessarily understand the full extent of our work. And if we don't explain it, how are they to know? So it makes sense to me that as decision makers in a variety of spheres change, and they do change fairly rapidly because we've mapped this over the years and we've brought people in as they've succeeded other folk in various roles, you have to start again and keep working on that agenda to try and make sure that people understand what it is your institution delivers and the good it does for society at large.
I'm wondering if you could tell me maybe two or three specific characteristics that you think a good university leader should have.
Oh, crumbs. I think the ability to try to influence people to go in the right direction. Some in my team might call it nagging, actually, at some stage. But at the end of the day, you have to try to make sure that if you have the picture of what the landscape is looking like, that you're translating that to the senior team, and for that matter to your staff more widely. We have routine staff meetings here to do that, and lunches with staff so that I can talk to people informally and so on. But we're quite a small institution, so we can do that sort of thing. I think that's really important. I think, as I said, bringing people into the organisation so that they understand better what it is that you do. It's difficult to get people to take that step, But again, it's the case of being persistent about it and making sure that you have a plan around what it is that would engage them when they come here. And we have a large number of things here, of course, in food and farming and veterinary science and all the other subjects that we operate that are of interest to people at national level as well as local. I think the ability to understand what it is that staff and students go through when they are at their work, whatever it might be, that's difficult because you don't necessarily have the time to do that. But I think talking and communicating to people all the time is part of the role, and it's really it's an important function really to be able to listen to people and not necessarily always say it's your view that matters and counts, and this is, you know, you have to be able to make decisions, but at the same time you have to listen to people. And in an academic environment, I think that's very important. You know, we have structures to allow that to happen, but the informal soundings that one takes as well are really essential. I was speaking to somebody in the corridor just yesterday about a research grant that has a Brexit-related issue at the minute that they're dealing with, and I said, well, what can I do to help? And that sort of informal bouncing of problems and ideas is really, really vital.
Hmm. And do you think that within academia itself, do you think that those, those lines of support are available to young academics who might want to eventually go into a more leadership position and make that crossover into university leadership? Is that there? And if it's not there, what do you think needs to be done to ensure the next generation?
Sure. I mean, I think there are various ways in which people can be supported in that way, in that route. You know, Advance HE is running programs which allow people to develop their leadership talents. And the top management program, of course, is the flagship for that once they get to that stage. I think also mentoring and support for people is really helpful. It's difficult sometimes, especially in a smaller institution, because the turnover of our staff here is fairly low, and so you don't necessarily have the openings here. But we do have people who progress elsewhere, and they move up towards more senior roles, and that's a good thing. You know, we want to make sure that we are providing a career path for them if that's their intention and their ambition. In a specialist institution, you have to find people in leadership roles who are at least aware of and can deal with the specialism. That's another added complication, I guess, in some ways. And in agriculture, those people aren't necessarily available in large numbers. I don't have an agricultural background. I have to read an awful lot to make sure that I can keep up with my staff. My staff are experts, so I don't need to be an expert in everything. What I need to be is to be able to pull in those talents when they're needed, to apply them to a particular problem or a challenge that we've got, or an opportunity that's out there that we feel that we can draw upon. So I think in those ways, you build those people through the experiences that you offer them, but you have to spot the talent and make sure those people are getting those opportunities to expand their career and their experience, I guess. Taking on projects, we've got people who are involved in international work here, which we've tried to push them towards that a little bit because we think that'll be good for the longer term. That sort of thing.
You mentioned Brexit earlier, so I feel feel okay asking you this question then. Farming is arguably the sector that's going to be most hit hardest by Brexit. So I'm just wondering, is this your biggest challenge to date in terms of preparing your community as the agricultural community and your students for life outside the EU? And what are you doing about it as a leader?
Well, funnily enough, we were just discussing it with our senior team yesterday in terms of no-deal Brexit planning. And I was talking to my chairman this morning, the chair of the board, about that very issue. I think there are two facets to it. Firstly, there's the university side, and we're planning for whatever outcome we're likely to get. And it's difficult to know entirely what that will be, but we're working on options for that in various scenarios. I think on the agricultural side, you're absolutely right. This is going to be quite a transition for the agricultural industry in the UK. There are various challenges coming out of that. There have been a whole heap of policies that have emerged from DEFRA, our government department, which haven't really got into legislation just yet, but we're anticipating that there will be a greater focus, obviously, on environmental land management, on climate change, on the way in which farming needs to adapt, on the adoption of new technologies to enable that adaptation to take place and for more efficient farming practices to be implemented. and for higher level skills as a consequence. So, you know, universities have a role to play in that sense, because we will need good agriculturalists, but we're also going to need good data scientists and robotics experts and other people who can contribute to food production in the future, whatever type of food that might be. Mm. And then, of course, more directly, we've been involved in talking to DEFRA, Government Office of Science, the Welsh Assembly Government and others about ways in which we can help. And we started that 2 months after the referendum result. We approached DEFRA at that stage. Unfortunately, the government wasn't quite ready. It's taken time for them, I think, to get started on their thinking around it. But over the last year or so, we've been involved in various trade discussions. We have a senior member of our staff, an emeritus professor, in fact, who's now working with DEFRA on a variety of things and helping advise certain aspects of trade negotiations in which he has particular expertise.
Hmm.
And we've also brought people in. We've actually got people in to talk to our students, the next generation of people who will have to deliver the food production systems of the future in the midst of all these changes. And that's been enlightening. You know, when you get the agricultural counsellor from the US embassy in to talk about trade, or the senior people from New Zealand talking about the High Commissioner from New Zealand, talking about what they went through when they relaxed their sort of position on farm support payments in New Zealand. You know, this was a big transition, and what he was telling us is, don't do it the way that we did it, do it like this. So we're trying to get our students exposed to some of these changes, because they're going to have to really work hard at them when the time comes for them to embark on their careers.
Would you say this is the biggest challenge you've faced as a vice chancellor?
No, there are plenty of other challenges I've faced as a vice chancellor. I mean, in terms of risk planning, then whatever happens in terms of HE funding is a big risk.
Mm. And also tied up with Brexit.
Mm. Student recruitment has been another issue, of course, over the last few years particularly. We've managed to hold our head above water on that, and 2019 looks pretty good, actually, so we're quite happy with that. But these have been the challenges that have been bubbling away under the surface whilst we've had to think about the consequences of Brexit on the wider industries with which we work.
Mm.
And the skills debate is one where we've been particularly busy, because there is now a national initiative looking at skills delivery for farming and for the food industry as it happens. And I'm part of that work, trying to represent the view that we need really highly skilled people to be able to deliver the business changes and the technological changes that are going to come about in food production in the future. And we're going to need them at a point, of course, when the number of 18-year-olds has bottomed out and the number of graduates coming out of the system in the UK is going to be at a low for the next 3 years. So in the midst of this Brexit transition, we're dealing with a demographic issue, and I'm trying to bring that to people's attention to make sure they understand it and that we broaden the pool then of people that we might want to bring into the industry. And the industry is listening to that. And the industry is also working hard, I think, on things like agricultural emissions, where there's a net zero target by 2040 that the NFU has talked about, mm-hmm. National Farmers Union,
mm-hmm.
because we recognise the fact that there's change needed. There's a lot of good work going on right now. Not all farming is the same, and there's some excellent practice going on. But we need to make sure gradually that standards are raised right across the piece.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.